Talkback with Gary Null, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to do something a little unusual. Instead of opening with the latest on health and healing, then going to the environment, our issue of the day, then guest, we're going to make the entire program about issues. We'll have Ralph Nader on talking about fluoride. We're also going to talk about the latest setback when it comes to protecting your rights through the Supreme Court when they're protecting the manufacturers of the vaccine, holding them harmless. So no matter how bad the vaccine is, no matter how many people are injured, they just profit. They have no incentive on their side to make sure that vaccines are safe and effective. Also, we're going to look at the whole idea of what most people don't understand. This monetizing debt, the fact that we now have a Federal Reserve that is printing money, astronomical amounts of money, and giving it to a relatively small group of inside corporations, banks, and others. They've conducted 21,000 transactions in secret, none of which are we aware of. And we only became aware that they did these 21,000 transactions for $3.3 trillion in cash, $13 trillion in guarantees, because Bernie Sanders of Vermont got the information. But we still don't know what the money was for. We know that they got it at zero interest, and they can do anything they want with it. So how is it that you can't get a break on your house, on your mortgage, you can't get the late fees on your credit card reduced, or your debit card that can go as high as 1,500% when you're late and don't make a payment? But the people who cause the problems, the wizards of Wall Street and the financial world, can get any amount of money they want if they're in that inside loop. And they try to keep saying, as long as we keep putting more money into the economy through the Federal Reserve, by buying up the Treasury notes, which now 75% of all of our notes at the Treasury auctions, the Federal Reserve buys. But then we pay interest on it. Well, who ends up getting the interest? The banks do. But what if they don't take the money? Well, that's an interesting little alchemy. The banks can be given money that they never actually take possession of. Then they are given an opportunity to pay down the Treasury with money they don't actually have, the Federal Reserve created out of thin air, and they get paid an interest on it. It amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars a year. It's just crazy. And the only one standing up for us in Congress is Ron Paul. He's demanding that we get rid of the Federal Reserve, at the very least audit it. And by the way, there's a majority of House members who agree with him, but nothing changes. So now just take a look at our economy. Look who's benefiting and who is not. That's where we're going to begin. Here is a tape trying to explain this. And then after this, call in. As each segment, feel free to call in.
Good morning, Bob. I'm glad I ran into you this morning. I read in the business section that the Federal Reserve is printing money.
Oh yeah, they've been doing that for years.
Okay, but shouldn't that be illegal? I mean, that sounds like counterfeiting.
Not at all. Counterfeiting is when a private citizen manufactures money in his basement for a B-rated movie. Printing money is when the Federal Reserve artificially increases the money supply,
How can the Fed print money, legally, when the B-rated movie actor gets arrested at the airport by the FBI with the counterfeit money in his duffel bag?
Because the Federal Reserve doesn't really print it, they just electronically create it out of thin air and credit the banks with the money.
And that's not counterfeiting?
No.
And it's perfectly legal?
Exactly.
And what's backing the fake money created by the Federal Reserve?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Not a damn thing.
This doesn't make any sense. Why would they do that?
Because the Fed gives the fake money to the banks, so they can lend it to American consumers to buy more shit they can't afford.
So why aren't people buying more shit they can't afford?
Because the banks don't give a rat's ass if Americans buy anything or not.
You lost me.
Just think about it for a moment. 5 years ago everyone had a big house, nice cars, a 50-inch flat-screen TV, and no damn money.
It's a beautiful country.
And all those mortgages and car notes and credit card debts were used as collateral for bonds.
That's dumb.
No, dumb is when you bought a $600,000 house on a $70,000 income.
I only paid $550.
Oh, that changes everything, except the fact that you still lost your house.
Condo.
In any event, all that debt was used as collateral for 38% of the bond market. The bonds were referred to as asset-backed securities and the banks made up the prices of these bonds themselves.
If I understand you correctly, the banks lent me money to buy the house I couldn't afford and used the mortgage I couldn't pay to collateralize bonds they sold to unsuspecting investors.
Yes.
Then the banks made up the price themselves.
Yes.
Okay, but what about the free markets?
Free markets are only important when politicians want to pass pro-business legislation, not when businesses need the government's help. So when people didn't pay their mortgages, the bonds on the balance sheets of the banks weren't worth jack shit and the banks claimed the money they would have otherwise lent to consumers went up in smoke.
I don't see the connection.
Well, the Fed thought that if the banks couldn't lend anyone money, the economy would collapse.
But what does any of this have to do with printing money?
The Federal Reserve used the electronically created money and bought the asset-backed securities that weren't worth jack shit in the free markets because the banks needed liquid assets to lend to consumers.
To buy more shit they couldn't afford.
Which is why they didn't lend it to them.
What?
The Federal Reserve gave the banks fake money in exchange for the asset-backed securities, but instead of lending the money to consumers, they used the proceeds to invest in the stock market.
That's straight up gangster.
And that's why the stock market has been going up. When the Fed creates currency out of thin air, the value of the dollar goes down, and if you look at a chart of the value of the dollar and the stock market, you'll see that they move in the opposite direction. As one goes up, the other goes down.
Run that by me again.
The banks take the fake dollars that increases the money supply and correspondingly reduces the value of the dollar. Then they use that money to buy stocks. As the demand for stocks goes up, so do the prices.
And that's printing money.
It used to be referred to as printing money, but now they call it quantitative easing.
As in get a bottle of wine and some Barry White music.
No, as in the Fed buys the toxic assets off the balance sheets of the banks like we just discussed.
Why can't they say printing money?
Because the American public figured out that printing money was a bad thing, began to dress up in silly George Washington costumes and demand fiscal responsibility.
Go on.
Then the financial industry came up with another catchy slogan, because investors pay more attention to the private life of Tiger Woods than they do their portfolios. Remember the Goldilocks economy, the smooth landing, and that about the green shoots theory?
Yes, but I always thought that when the Federal Reserve expands the money supply, it causes inflation. So why haven't we seen interest rates go up?
Because the Federal Reserve also lends the banks more fake money that isn't backed by anything of value at 0.25%.
And let me guess.
The banks instead lend the same money back to the broke-ass government by purchasing treasury bonds that pay 3%.
Nobody's that stupid.
Studies show that one-fifth of Americans can't locate the United States on a map.
That's an anomaly.
But that's 20% of the population who don't know where the hell they live.
What does that have to do with the Federal Reserve lending money to the banks, that the banks in turn use to buy treasury bonds?
Well, it seems the government owes $13.5 trillion and has a $1.5 trillion budget deficit.
And you talk about my bad financial decisions?
You can't print money.
You can't grow facial hair.
So the government borrows money by selling bonds to China and Japan, but foreign countries are beginning to realize we can't pay it back. To compensate for the decreasing international demand for our debt, the Federal Reserve gives fake money to the banks so they can use it to buy government bonds.
So the first batch, quantitative easing, wasn't enough, so now they're
printing money.
Printing money to lend to the banks so the banks can lend it back to the broke-ass government.
Yes. You see, the government has to refinance 36% of its debt in 2010.
And Bernie Madoff is in jail because?
And 60% of the debt will mature over the next 3 years.
Why does this sound familiar?
Essentially, this is the adjustable rate mortgage crisis on steroids, because more than half of the United States obligations come due by the end of 2013, and right now the government pays 1.25% on that debt, which will probably be refinanced at higher rates.
No, this sounds more like money laundering. The Federal Reserve manufactures illegitimate money and funnels it through the banks, so they can give it to the government in a more legitimate form. If you or I did this, we would go to jail.
Yes, you would go to jail. Let me just expand on this for a few moments to give you a larger picture. Any other country in the world that monetized its debt and created a fiat currency, meaning you have nothing to back it up, no asset, and you keep doing this and giving it out, but not to the people, not to the small businesses, not to help people who are out of work to create new works or to create new manufacturing, but rather continue to give it to the people who control $2 trillion in liquid cash to begin with that they've been sitting on, and to trade in currencies. After all, if you're getting money for free, let's say you're Goldman Sachs and you borrow $100 billion from the Federal Reserve at zero interest, you could exchange bad investments, toxic assets. Those toxic assets are where your managers made bad bets, and now the government, we the people, take your bad bets, your losses, and we wash them. It's a form of legal money laundering. We take your bad debts from your people who made mistakes, we take all that, we give you new clean money at zero interest. You turn around and then you pay off, you pay the treasury, and as a result, you get interest. But hold on a second, you didn't pay anything for that money to begin with. So how in this circle are you getting money off money that you didn't earn and didn't cost you anything? Or you go to Brazil, a flaming economy, or you go to India or China, undervalued currencies, and you bet on those currencies, you could make 6-8% interest. That's 600-800% profit. There is virtually zero accountability in the financial world today. It's all alchemy. My view is that every single corporation in America that fails should go out of business, go through a structured bankruptcy, and those people shouldn't be hired again unless you want to go bankrupt again. At least the people got the company into debt, not the actual workers. What the Federal Reserve and this government should have done is give no-interest loans to people that actually will create jobs in America, providing that the money goes to an economy where it has to stay in the economy. So if you want to open up a dry cleaners or a restaurant or making bicycles or whatever it is, you hire people at a living wage, not a starvation wage, so that that money circulates. That would have been a right way to have done this. Now they're going to have at least two or three more, I predict, in the next 3 years, probably one per year for the next 3 years, quantitative easing, where they'll give over $1 trillion this time. Now this is in addition to the 13 they've guaranteed, so we're now up over $20 trillion, and I have zero to show for it. That's your government at work. And why this isn't a major issue being discussed is beyond me. But I like your thoughts. That's our first issue of the day. Give us a call. The forum is open. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. You and I were supposed to be financially responsible. We're supposed to balance our budget with our income so we don't spend what we don't have. We're supposed to look realistically about what we actually need for our health and happiness and for survival. And we're supposed to be able to work at a job that pays us a living wage. Those are becoming more and more difficult. As a result, more and more Americans are falling to a level of inequality that we have never seen before, with over 240 million Americans above, slightly at or below the poverty level. Nothing is being done for them, nor will anything being done for them, because there's no advocates out there for them. No demonstrations, no marches. That's unfortunate. Now, that's our first issue. Now I'm going to give you another one. Ralph Nader on fluoride. For years, he was pro-fluoride.
Many years ago, when I looked into the fluoridation issue, I asked the question, who shall decide? This obviously deals with a chemical application to the public drinking water designed ostensibly to reduce cavities, which is a non-contagious ailment. The question should be, who decides? And in more and more communities, it's a administrative or regulatory agency that is making the decision without adequate public input. I think that's wrong. If you're going to put a chemical like a fluoride in the public drinking water without even coming to the conclusion about the total fluoride intake in the community from other sources of fluoride before you make the decision, that's not up to anybody but the people by referendum preceded by an informed debate. That is not happening in most communities now in America. My hometown in Connecticut was fluoridated by a precipitous decision of a state agency with no input from the residents of that community. When a state agency rules it, it overrides the local municipal agencies, it overrides a local referendum, and in effect says to the people that when you open your faucet, there's going to be something in that drinking water added that you did not give consent to. Now, it's one thing if it's an epidemic disease. This is not an epidemic disease. What's happened is the Public Health Service and the U.S. government refuses to even have any kind of update analysis. The matter was closed scientifically several decades ago by the U.S. government, which is the principal promoter of fluoridated drinking water. And that's not a scientific attitude, in my judgment. One of the definitions of science is that it has to keep open options for revision. And the idea that there's no debating critics of fluoridated water, there's no reevaluation in a deliberate manner, it's a taboo, and it's an unfortunate taboo. There's a very strong core that's been built up that looks at fluoridated drinking water as a closed matter. It's not the first time that's happened in public health, but once that happens, you get a vested interest. You get a vested interest of the scientists who bought into it. You get a vested interest of the bureaucrats who don't want to be exposed for having made the wrong decision. You get a vested interest for the industry that sells the fluoride. And all that combines with a juggernaut that makes the critics of fluoridation sometimes so desperate that they don't make sound claims. They exaggerate the alarms, and then they are tainted as being wackos. And so it's not a fair evaluation in a cool, thoughtful manner of all the pros and cons, but more important, of why the decision to fluoridate drinking water in community after community is taken away from public referendum and a decision by the people.
That's Ralph Nader, and I think he nailed it when he said by public referendum. Now, on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, on our homepage, is a definitive article showing that there is no science supporting that we should be using fluoride, challenging that it prevents all the tooth decay we've been led to believe, and then only in a few studies does it show that it benefits only slightly children to a certain age. Well, what about everyone who has to drink the water? Why would you medicate an entire society with such tenuous science for such a small percentage of the population, and then come the risk factors, including 30,000 preventable deaths from cancer each year from the fluoride at 1 part per million. Now, recently, the CDC has acknowledged, along with the FDA, that 1 part per million of fluoride causes dental mottling, and that's permanent, where you brown stain the teeth. And yet, now that they're bringing it back down, no one's gone in and said, hold on a second, were you the same agency that said it's safe, it doesn't cause a problem? Now you're saying, yes, it does cause a problem? What else were they wrong about? Well, that's the whole idea. They were wrong about its impact upon the immune system, its impact upon neutrophils and other parts of the immune system. Read the article. It's there as a public service, and it's fully referenced. And if you want to get fluoride out of your local drinking water, use the article as a way of bringing together a referendum and show the science. Time after time, when people have gone in and fought, they have won and defluoridated the water. I'm just glad that Ralph Nader is finally coming to a position of acknowledging what we've been saying for decades, that fluoridation of our drinking water is mass medication without freedom of choice. Just like vaccines. If you want a vaccine, you have every right to that vaccine. But for those of us who feel that the science supporting its safety and efficacy for any given individual is not there, we should have the right to opt out. Not in today's society, unfortunately. Your thoughts on this? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. The lack of freedom of choice in supposedly a democracy, where in fact the pharmaceutical industries and corporate America's policies of profiting rule. And finally, we'll take, well, before we go to our next one, we're going to talk with Brian from New Jersey. Hi, Brian, your thoughts.
Hello?
Can you hear me? I can hear you, Brian. You don't have to yell.
I'm sorry. I just want to say I agree with everything you were saying and concerning the clip that was on there and everything that was saying in the clip. I think the best thing that we can do to combat it is take all our money out of banks, especially big banks, and invest in gold and silver so that the effect of the devaluing of the dollar won't have as much of an impact. I also agree with everything you're saying about fluoride, and I'm trying to write a letter and get support to get evidence that healthcare to be based on evidence-based practice and to be supported in that matter. Okay. And if anybody's interested, I could give my email so that they could be a part of that, so to raise the standard of our healthcare.
Give your email.
BOURNE, the number 4, PT14, and hotmail.com.
Why didn't you make it a little longer and confusing? Jesus, Brian, make it simple. Thanks, Brian. Just a point. In Ireland today, they're being asked to give up a lot of their benefits, their pensions, their assistance with food and children's education, lots of givebacks. Why? So that the government can give that money to the banks, the very banks who made the mistake of gambling. So in Greece, the same thing, France, Italy, the United States, wherever there's a problem, the banks are behind it. And I agree that we should take our money out of large banks and put them into small quality savings loan, do a little homework, make sure it's a solvent one, and one that doesn't engage in derivative trading, credit default swaps, a legitimate savings loan, or credit union. And then stop buying things from Walmart or your large department stores. Tear up your credit cards and live as frugally as you can, because for every dollar you take out of them being able to manipulate you, you're doing a good thing. Remember, they make money when you spend money you don't have, when you're living through debt. We'll say hello to another caller. Give us a call now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We'll take some more calls now. And we're going now to our next segment, which is Barbara Fisher, talking about why she's concerned when the Supreme Court sides with the vaccine manufacturers, holding them harmless, no matter how bad or toxic or deadly the vaccine they've created is for anyone. You can't sue a vaccine maker anymore. Here's what she has to say.
How do you lose so much weight? What kind of diet are you on?
The short answer is, I went on essentially a plant-based diet. I live on beans.
Sorry that my engineer made a mistake. That was Bill Clinton. That's our last one. We'll go to Barbara Lowe Fisher here.
My name is Barbara Lowe Fisher. My son was injured by DPT vaccine in 1980, and this is a commentary brought to you by the nonprofit National Vaccine Information Center. On February 22, 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court shielded drug companies from all liability for harm caused by vaccines mandated by government when companies could have made a safer vaccine. From now on, drug companies selling vaccines in America will not be held accountable by a jury of our peers in a court of law if those vaccines brain damage us but could have been made less toxic. If you get paralyzed by a flu shot, or your child has a serious reaction to a vaccine required for school and becomes learning disabled, epileptic, autistic, asthmatic, diabetic, or mentally retarded, you are on your own. From now on, unless we stand up and draw the line on vaccine mandates, the government can legally use police powers to force every American to get hundreds of vaccinations or be punished, while those who are hurt by vaccination can be more easily swept under the rug and left to fend for themselves. To understand how this happened, we have to turn the clock back to 1982. That is when four big drug companies blackmailed Congress by threatening to stop selling vaccines in America unless a law was passed giving them complete immunity from prosecution. The pharmaceutical industry knew they were in big trouble because the old, crude whooping cough vaccine in the DPT shot was causing brain inflammation and death in many children. The live oral polio vaccine was crippling children and adults with vaccine-strained polio, and Americans were filing lawsuits to hold drug companies responsible for the safety of their products. One day after the Supreme Court blocked lawsuits against drug companies for failing to make vaccines safer, they cleared the way for lawsuits against car manufacturers for failing to make seatbelts safer. Civil liability is a consumer protection. In the past, civil liability has protected us from wealthy tobacco corporations selling cigarettes that were once endorsed by doctors and the U.S. government. Civil liability has protected us from defective cars and toys and food and drugs that have passed federal licensing and safety standards. Civil liability put pressure on drug companies to develop and license a less toxic pertussis vaccine in 1996, and it put pressure on federal health agencies to replace use of a contaminated neurotoxic polio vaccine that can paralyze people with one that cannot. Yes, 30 years ago, the wealthiest and most powerful industry lobbying on Capitol Hill and in state legislatures, the multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry, tried very hard to get total liability protection for every vaccine the government regulates, recommends, and mandates. The only difference is that three decades ago, government officials were ordering doctors to give children 23 doses of seven vaccines. And today, that direct order is up to 70 doses of 16 vaccines. The parent co-founders of the National Vaccine Information Center worked with Congress back in the early 1980s, and we refused to support any legislation that would legally let the pharmaceutical industry completely off the hook. Parents successfully argued that if Congress was going to give drug companies partial liability protection through the creation of a federal vaccine injury compensation alternative to a lawsuit, then language had to be written into the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 that protected a citizen's right to sue drug companies when federal compensation was denied or the company had the technological ability to make a vaccine less toxic but refused to do it. Continued civil liability was the safety net for American consumers in that law. Continued civil liability was the leverage that gave some financial incentive to drug companies to make vaccines safer and gave some political incentive to government officials to award federal compensation to the vaccine injured. Now, six activist Supreme Court judges have ripped the liability safety net from the U.S. mass vaccination system and written Big Pharma a blank check by deliberately ignoring the language and legislative history of the 1986 Vaccine Injury Act. Only Supreme Court Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, in an accurate and brilliant dissenting opinion, stood up for the people. Now it will be much easier for employees in government health agencies and the U.S. Department of Justice and the Vaccine Court to deny vaccine victims federal compensation, which 308 million Americans pay for through a surcharge on each one of the annual flu shots and the dozens of doses of vaccines public health officials say we all should get. There is $3 billion waiting to be awarded in the Vaccine Injury Trust Fund, which has already been raided by federal agencies, dragging vaccine victims through years of litigation and looking for ways to deny vaccine risks. The Supreme Court has now given pharma and evangelistic doctors a green light to lobby legislators to require every American who lives to be 78 years old to get more than 130 doses of government-recommended vaccines starting on the day of birth throughout the last year of life. And that does not include use of any of the hundreds of new vaccines now being developed by drug companies with government approval that will be required in the future, whether those vaccines are necessary or not, whether the vaccines work or not, whether the vaccines are dangerous or not, and whether the people want to use the vaccines or not. This is not public health. This is exploitation of a captive people by a pharmaceutical industry seeking unlimited profits and by doctors in positions of authority who have never seen a vaccine they did not want to mandate. It is a drug company stockholder's dream, a health care consumer's worst nightmare, and a prescription for tyranny. Americans are required by law to use more vaccines than any other nation in the world. In no other country, not in Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, the Netherlands, Germany, Japan, or in any other country, are citizens subjected to mandatory use of dozens of doses of vaccines under the threat of being denied a public education and health insurance and employment. There is no other word for this but tyranny. Vaccines are pharmaceutical products that carry a risk of injury or death, a risk that can be greater for some than others. If a vaccine is effective, then those choosing to use that vaccine will have nothing to fear from those who make another healthcare choice. If a vaccine is not effective, then consumers are being asked to take two risks, a risk they will be harmed and a risk the vaccine will not work at all. That is not a product that should be legally required, especially when doctors cannot predict ahead of time who will be harmed by a vaccine, and there is no civil liability for the company selling it, the person giving it, or the government official mandating it. No liability, no accountability, no mandates. If corporations are in business to make money, if doctors can make mistakes, if judges can get it wrong, if what is considered scientific truth today can turn out to be not true tomorrow, and if nobody is held accountable in the civil justice system for vaccines that could have been made safer, then now is the time for all Americans to stand up for health freedom in this great nation of ours. There is no freedom more fundamental than the human right to be free to decide what risks we are willing to take with our lives and our children's lives. Please join with the nonprofit National Vaccine Information Center, the largest, oldest, and most experienced vaccine safety and informed consent watchdog in America. Help us help you stand up for your right to know and freedom to choose which vaccines that you consider necessary, safe, and effective enough to use.
That's Barb Lo Fisher explaining, once again, what most people are not aware of. Look at the actual science. This past week, I did an enormous amount of filming all over the country. Filmed in Berkeley, was in Atlanta, filmed in New York. And two of the leading medical doctors, both women, talking about vaccines, both said there is no science they could find that can prove a given vaccine can be both safe and effective for any given person, and therefore they don't recommend them and won't use them. And yet, we are being mandated to take them, and if we don't, all forms of problems could involve our being disciplined. What form that will take depends upon which direction that the FDA and the CDC decide to go. But now it's just a heyday. It's a profit stream for pharmaceutical companies with bad science. But they have the power of the government on their side and the regulatory agencies. America went to sleep. And this is what they got when they woke up. At least those who are awake. Your thoughts on this? Once again, no freedom of choice. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Our final segment is former President Bill Clinton. Now, you heard me mention about 3 years ago that it was my opinion that the bypass surgery, quadruple bypass surgery he had would only be a stopgap. It was not curative, and he would reocclude based upon his previous lifestyle, that he would have to take a radical change. A high percentage of raw food, juices, supplements, exercise, and lots of fruits and vegetables. A high vegetarian diet. And if he did that, then there was every reason to believe that he would be able to keep his arteries from reoccluding and heal the epithelial tissue and also heal the brain, at least turn off the inflammation that would lead to the next step, which I predict would be Alzheimer's or dementia. They almost always follow, because whatever causes inflammation in your arteries will cause inflammation in your brain and lays down a particular type of plaque, an amyloid plaque that is present in most people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. Here's what he had to say in an interview.
How did you lose so much weight? What kind of diet are you on?
The short answer is I went on essentially a plant-based diet. I live on beans, legumes, vegetables, fruit. I drink a protein supplement every morning. No dairy. I drink almond milk mixed in with fruit and a protein powder, so I get the protein for the day when I start the day out. And it changed my whole metabolism, and I lost 24 pounds. And I got back to basically what I weighed in high school. But I did it for a different reason. I mean, I wanted to lose a little weight, but I didn't ever dream this would happen. I did it because after I had this stent put in, I realized that even though it happens quite often that after you have bypasses, you lose the veins because they're thinner and weaker than arteries, the truth is that it clogged up, which means that the cholesterol was still causing buildup in my vein that was part of my bypass. And thank God I could take the stents. I don't want it to happen again. So I did all this research, and I saw that 82% of the people since 1986 who have gone on a plant-based, no dairy, no meat of any kind, no chicken, turkey. I eat very little fish. Once in a while, I'll have a little fish. Not often. If you can do it, 82% of the people who've done that have begun to heal themselves. Their arterial blockage cleans up. The calcium deposit around their heart breaks up. This movement has been led by a doctor named Caldwell Esselstyn at the Cleveland Clinic, Dean Ornish in Manoa in California, the doctors Campbell, father and son, who wrote the China study, and a handful of others. But we now have 25 years of evidence. And so I thought, well, since I need to lose a little weight for Chelsea's wedding, I'll become part of this experiment. I'll see if I can be one of those that can have a self-clearing mechanism. We'll see.
I hope you're healthy for many years and get to see grandchildren for many years.
Me too. That's really the big deal. You know, Hillary and I, we're happy. We love our son-in-law and we admire him, but and we'd like to be around. If there's grandkids, we want to be there to do our part.
Mr. President, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for what you're doing.
I also, as I'm sure most of you, wish him only good health. And for two reasons. First, because I believe everyone has a right to live a long and healthy life, but also this would be one of the very first times that a major policymaker, not an opinion leader, is able to lead a movement by their own actions. And in the strange world that we live in, even if you have all the truth on your side, if you're not a policymaker and opinion leader like a big celebrity, then there's a very little probability that the mass of people will ever pay attention to you. They're waiting for the leaders, or those that speak on behalf of the leaders. And he is certainly a leader. So when he makes a change, people will pay attention. We'll probably get more people looking towards a vegetarian diet now because what he's doing for himself in a good way than the movement in the last 10 years or so. So, but that's good. I'm very, very happy with his progress, and hopefully he'll continue. And there's a whole lot more that could help him, but once again, that has to come from those who are outside of the Orthodox, a part of that, those who are more complementary and who go in, rebalance his brain chemistry, re-stimulate a natural immune system, and help him detox. But he's made a major step, and that's a good thing. Your thoughts on that? Give us a call, 888-874-4888. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and then we'll take your calls on any of the topics that we have shared these audio insights with you. Nice to have you with us, everyone. My engineer told me we were flooded with calls, but all on different issues, not on these particular issues. That's all right. You have to have an issue that you feel confident and comfortable dealing with. I think these are all important, and I will open the lines up to other issues now, so you can call us on whatever issue you find is important to you at 888-874-4888. And while those calls are coming in now, let's go over and say hello to Dr. Martin Feldman. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Gary. I want to talk a little bit about some new research on migraine headaches. First off would be the diagnosis of the headache, and that often involves one side of the head, severe pain, throbbing, often accompanied with nausea, often with sensitivity to light, often with visual auras in their field, and it may be bad enough that people have to go into a dark room. 28 million Americans, roughly, have migraine headaches. It's a lot of people, 28 million, and three-quarters of them are women. And this is a very debilitating type problem unless it's fixed. And it can be fixed. And often people turn to medication, such as Imitrex is a popular one, or over-the-counter medicines of all types, anti-pain medicine. And it may help somewhat, but we want to do a more natural approach. And the new research out there, very, very important, is a review of 22 studies, meta-analysis of 22 major studies involving 4,400 participants, 4,000 people with migraine headaches, showed that acupuncture reduced both the symptom intensity and the frequency of the headaches. And the acupuncture was much more effective than drugs or placebo or anything else in terms of just that issue, acupuncture versus drugs and placebo. Also, I did the research, I found that there were also articles on acupuncture for tension headaches. Tension headaches are much less a problem. They're less severe, involve usually the diffuse front of the head, and they're minor. But again, a major study, 2,300 people, study subjects, receiving acupuncture said the number of their headaches was reduced by more than half. That's a very, very good start. In New York State, acupuncturists are licensed, so that you can look up online for New York State acupuncturists who are licensed by the state, and you should consider acupuncture as a major part of all headache therapy. There are two other major parts, though, of headache control, especially migraine. And first would be allergy. And the allergy can be dietary and or environmental, but can be both. And it can be single food or food combination, or it could be additives to food. You've got three aspects. Now, especially bitter alcoholic beverages. For example, red wine and beer are among the worst, we'll call it, triggers for migraine headache, causing the most severe headaches. You really got to watch it if you have any headaches at all. tyramine, which is a chemical found in cheese, smoked fish, and yogurt, among other places. Often that's a very major trigger as well. MSG, monosodium glutamate, found in Chinese foods and some processed foods, also a very, very severe problem, as is sodium nitrate. Sodium nitrates are often found in cold cuts and hot dogs, which people shouldn't be eating at all, but just if you have headaches, that's something you've got to avoid for sure. Aspartame is also commonly a trigger for migraine headaches, as is chocolate or caffeine in any form. Now, beyond all those, the common allergies out there, which are across the board, not just headaches, but for many other aspects, wheat, dairy products, corn and eggs, especially for headache. And there's a large amount of environmental toxins out there, which also can provoke the headache. We've got two things. So we've got acupuncture, we've got the allergy reduction. Third would be chiropractic. Chiropractic is very, very helpful for, in my practice, I see a lot of people with headaches, and I often have to refer to chiropractors, and I found that about roughly 75% of people coming to me with severe headaches benefit from skilled chiropractic care. And so that really should be emphasized as part of the medical model right now. Traditional physicians rarely would send a headache patient to a chiropractor, but I do it all day long. And so we have three aspects. We've got to watch, do acupuncture with skill, reduce the allergy process, watch your foods, and third, you might need chiropractic help. And with these, you can have even two or even all three of these to help you with headaches. And with all these three, almost all headaches can be controlled.
Marty, one of our audience just asked about sleep apnea. Now, how do you work with sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea requires more of a mechanical issue whereby there are, in New York City anyway, a number of sleep study centers where the patient or the participant goes to a sleep study center and they monitor the person during the night. And if they find sleep apnea, then they have to often use mechanical aspects, certain special masks and special apparatus to help with the sleep apnea. That would be the first step. The second step is often people are obese with sleep apnea, and they may have a problem in the throat in terms of mechanics of the throat are not right, and that requires also that complex issue. So there are two major aspects. One is obesity and mechanical part of the actual throat itself, and another is, for want of a better word, apparatus to help with the sleep masks.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Martin Feldman, and he's a board-certified neurologist, holistic doctor, and his number is 212-744-4413. Okay, well, we just answered Fran's call on sleep apnea. Any other calls, be happy to take. We have about 7 minutes left in the program at 888-874-4888. And I got three calls asking about what is the latest out there on preventing headaches. Well, here's the latest from my point of view. Marty was just talking about one type. Dull tension headaches, put a few drops of peppermint essential oil onto your temples. Peppermint appears to prevent your body from sending pain signals to your central nervous system. According to one German study, peppermint works as well as 1,000 milligrams of ibuprofen. Then mix 1 teaspoon of finely ground cinnamon, it's called dalcini in India, 1 teaspoon of water and apply it to the forehead. And this remedy can be very effective for headaches caused by exposure to cold air. And then lying down in a dark room and perhaps getting just an hour or two of sleep, it'll almost always make you feel better, especially if you have a headrest, so your head is cradled in a headrest. For many people, vanilla may be the key to eliminating headaches. Vanilla extract contains what is called eugenol, eugenol. That's an essential oil that has antiseptic and analgesic properties and that can help unclog blood vessels. And the ancient Egyptians discovered that vanilla bean would cure a headache almost every time, regardless of how serious the duration or intensity. And though they did not discover why vanilla worked, they found that it was 3 times more effective than their previous best treatment, which is turmeric. And one headache sufferer reported that nothing had worked for his constant headache for 40 years until he turned to vanilla. And he drank a tiny amount of pure vanilla extract, diluted in 8 ounces of water before going to bed. And the next morning, the usual headache pain was only half its normal intensity, and 2 days later it was gone completely and hasn't returned in over a year. And there are other migraines. For example, adding to what Marty was saying, with migraines, to prevent and relieve migraines, grind 1-inch piece of ginger root and add to an 8-ounce glass of fruit juice, and I suggest grapefruit juice. And magnesium, as he mentioned, deficiency can cause migraines. Taking a hot shower followed by a cold shower for 5 minutes each, as hot and as cold as you can stand it, may relieve migraines in as little as 20 minutes. And grind lemon peels and apply as a paste to the forehead. And that also has been beneficial. Now, for sinus headaches, if you eat a small piece of jalapeno pepper as soon as possible, it'll help drain the sinuses and relieve the headache. Also, peppermint steam inhalation acts as a decongestant and can quickly relieve sinus headaches. And make a paste from dry ginger and with a little water, apply to the forehead. So, and also try a hot foot bath along with cold compresses on the forehead. All that works well. Let's say hello to Bill from Long Island. Hi, Bill.
Wait.
Hi, Bill.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. How's it going?
Great.
My question has to do with veganism. I know we heard a clip from Bill Clinton just before. Is it possible that there is a segment of the population for whom a vegan diet is not healthy? Found for myself that for the last 10 years I've been trying to find like a healthy diet for myself, meaning what's going to make me feel the best. And it seems like any time I engage in a very low fat, like a Campbell-type diet or John McDougall. I've read his books, and we have two sides of the situation here. We have doctors like Calipay, Braverman, and probably 50 others who advocate meat eating because they believe a complete diet is the healthiest diet.
Well, again, you have to separate out what they believe from what they practice themselves. That's always the key. People will always defend what they practice. Now, that is historical on all levels. So it's no different than the D'Amato diet or the blood type diet. I gave several thousand people the same identical vegan diet, and they all did well, irrespective of their blood type. Well, if that was the case, that they would only respond to a particular type of meat-based diet or vegetarian diet, then you wouldn't have seen everyone have that universal impact. Here is the key. When it comes to amino acids, the building blocks of protein, whether you get your amino acids from an egg or a legume, you're still getting the amino acids. The key is to understand what type and quality of amino acids you're getting and how it's been prepared so that you get the maximum utilization. Quite frankly, a lot of the people who are vegans are unhealthy vegans because their selections are not healthy. It's also true for a lot of vegetarians. And also, most are rather clueless about the quality of the oils, and you must have quality oils in the diet because oils are essential for your immune system and also for helping make hormones and for energy. So if you're just going on a vegan diet without the full knowledge how to do it, the likelihood is you're going to end up fatigued and your mitochondria will suffer and then you won't feel good on it. But done correctly, everybody benefits from a vegan diet, and they underline correctly. Okay? I'm looking at our time, and we're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking this hour and sharing it. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.